Thank you and welcome for joining the first PACE session in 2022. The results for the poll that you did are right there. There are around about 30% of people so far who have joined are new to this. So we'll introduce you to what PACE is. Out of you, 70%, almost 70% have a pet, and a good 33% don't have a pet. And I'm surprised nobody is attending so that they can decide whether they want to have a pet or not. We'll see what happens. This is a good mix that half of you, almost just more than half of you, were not surprised. Oh, there you go, Carlos, you brought your pet, as we talked. So yes, pets were welcome. So yes, it is surprising, but not really so. That was the aim of PACE. So tonight the format is as usual, but it is slightly different. Jennifer Gilmer from the NHH Foundation will be playing PACE host, and she will be taking over from me. And she will do the introductions and go from there. So over to you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you. So as Dr. Bargava said, welcome to the first PACE Talk of 2022. So I have the pleasure of hosting tonight as one of our PACE partners, but I'm going to keep my introduction to the group and PACE as short as I can so we can really dive into this main topic. I think my dog and I are both pretty excited for this one, so ready to get into it. PACE, for those of you who don't know, stands for Personalized Assessment and Change Education. It's a collaborative effort between community healthcare partners, and I'm here representing one of these partners. I'm with NHH Foundation. We also have Northumberland Hills Hospital, and I believe Jennifer Gillard's on the line here, and I know I saw Susan, who's our CEO and president, and of course, Dr. Bargava is our chief of staff. Dr. Bargava also represents another PACE partner, IM Care, which is his practice. Community Health Centers of Northumberland is a partner, and I don't think I've seen Taryn join yet, and Northumberland Family Health Team, and Adrian Bell-Smith, if she's on the call, could wave. Loyalist College is another partner of ours, and I wanted to just give a quick shout out. This session is being recorded, and Loyalist College, there's a group of students there in the Media Studies program that help us with, they take this recording and they edit it and make it a bit more professional and really help us to share it broader and let people join and see it if they weren't able to attend. So thank you to that group as well. And I've seen a couple of them joined. So PACE is really a series of talks that we host each year. It typically runs from October to June. This schedule got a little off track this year, but typically it would be October to June. And each topic reflects integrative medicine. So it's not just conventional medicine. It's not just focusing on one specialty or another. It's really that broader integrative approach. Each talk consists of a main presentation, usually around 25 minutes, and then a question and answer period. And I know we've already received a few questions in advance of this one, so I think it's going to be a really good discussion. One of the great things about PACE also is that everyone involved is a volunteer. So there's no sponsorship or remuneration for speakers. The speakers join and help share their knowledge as volunteers. PACE is not about funding. It's not about the government or hospital or public health policy. And the speakers are not providing personal treatment or advice. These talks are really just meant to be more of a conversation starter for our community. So with that understanding of what PACE is, I'll introduce tonight's moderator, Denise O'Brien, who's going to introduce our main speaker, Dr. Janet Hoy-Gerlach, and help facilitate tonight's conversation. Denise is really a perfect fit for this role tonight. She was instrumental in connecting us with Dr. Hoy-Gerlach. Denise sits on my board, so NHH Foundation's board of directors, and works as an industrial organizational psychology practitioner. Outside of work, she is active in the community and she volunteers with the local rescue, Canine Crusaders. Knowing her background in psychology, as well as her personal love of dogs, I think she has a couple dogs, maybe even a few dogs herself. We reached out to her to see if she knew of anyone who might be able to speak on the topic of pets and wellness. And thankfully, it was an area of interest for her, and I believe she had already read Dr. Hoy-Gerlach's book. So she offered to reach out to her on our behalf to see if she'd be interested in participating, and Dr. Hoy-Gerlach graciously agreed to join us tonight, all the way from Toledo, Ohio. So with that, Denise, I'll turn it over to you.
Great, thank you. Good evening, everyone. When I was asked to moderate the conversation, I responded with an enthusiastic absolutely, because obviously dogs, as Jen mentioned, are sort of near and dear to my heart. So I come to the topic with some firsthand anecdotal experience of the many benefits of pet ownership and companionship. So the pandemic has been a time of lots of change, and we've been pushed to consider and maybe even try some new things. Our conversations this evening on pets and wellness may provide some good food for thought in terms of how can we help ourselves stay well. And based on the poll, it sounds like many of you are already on the right track. So carry on. As we continue to navigate through the pandemic, I think it's an important and timely topic. This pets and wellness is definitely a timely topic for sure. And I'm excited to learn from our guests this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce our expert speaker, Dr. Janet Hoy-Gerlach. Dr. Hoy-Gerlach brings to her work more than 20 years of experience in community mental health service delivery. An advocate of recognizing and supporting the bonds between people and animals with social work practice across settings and populations, in 2017, Dr. Hoy-Gerlach wrote Human-Animal Interaction, a Social Work Guide. Her current research is focused on the health benefits of the human-animal bond, specifically as it relates to emotional support animals. She has trained and presented nationally and internationally on emotional support animals and has served as an expert witness on the topic for the U.S. Department of Justice and Civil Rights. Dr. Hoy-Gerlach founded and co-convenes the annual Human-Animal Interaction and Social Work Research Group meeting at the Society of Social Work and Research annual national meeting. In her role as Human Services Advisor for Ohio Animal Advocates, she has provided expert legislative testimony on bills and issues related to human-animal interaction issues, such as cross-reporting of human and animal abuse. A professor of social work at the University of Toledo, Dr. Hoy-Gerlach primarily teaches social work practices and research classes. We are extremely fortunate to have her join us this evening, all the way from, as Jen said, Toledo. So welcome, Dr. Hoy-Gerlach. I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Denise, and thanks to all of you for being here tonight. I'm loving seeing the pets popping up here and there. So I have a cat, Dominique, who may do a pass by. We'll have to see. As cats go, she's very cat-like, so it has to be her idea, as those of you with kitties well know. So I'd like to start by sharing with you a little story about how I came to be here speaking in front of you. This whole human-animal bond as a way to benefit human health and well-being really kind of took root many years ago when I was working in social work as a full-time clinician doing suicide risk assessments. And as I had been trained to do, one thing I would always ask people who were experiencing suicidality would be, what has stopped you up until now from acting on your, you know, suicidal thoughts, your suicidal plan? And I got a lot of the responses that I had been trained in my social work coursework and taught in supervision and, additional training in suicide risk assessment, the kind of answers we were taught to listen and look for, things like, I can't do that to my family or my friends, I can't leave my kids, it's against my spiritual beliefs, my faith, it's a wrong sin, etc. However, often enough that it gave me pause was a response that some variation of I can't leave my pet. And two things about that struck me. The first thing being, as somebody who's very attached to my animals and has always had a really strong connection, I got it, right? I understood how somebody could have that kind of a strong bond. The second thing that struck me was I had never had this presented to me in any sort of professional mental health or healthcare training as a, what we call a protective factor. So these were people that were literally telling me they were still alive in part because of their pets. And I have a colleague now who talks a lot about low-hanging fruit. If we're talking about, you know, studying things and understanding things and you know, there's rocket science. I actually work with rocket scientists. We have a observatory, a planetarium. They study the composition of the universe. And I'll say this is not rocket science. This is much more straightforward than that. You know, but many of us have already had these experiences, and it's about, you know, bringing the science and the research in to help us better understand how our animals are helping us. And then once we get that, you know, how can we be more intentional about bringing them in as partners, you know, the buddy system with a bit of a variation, you know, having kind of a little, you know, four-legged or big, you know, furry kind of buddy to help us in our self-care. So I have prepared some slides, a lot of pictures, just to help illustrate some of the concepts we're going to look at. And let's see. So I think we can go ahead. Next slide. This is the title, Health Benefits and the Human-Animal Bond. I just shared with you basically how I came to be here. So from that realization, doing risk assessments, you know, another area, you know, in addition to the human-animal bond, health and mental health benefits is, again, I've been a mental health practitioner for many years, and I essentially worked and started bringing that together. And then fast forwarding to now, it's really been a journey of learning to understand how animals can benefit human health and well-being, which sort of begs the question, why are we, you know, even talking about our relationships with pets? I mean, I brought up the suicide example, and that's certainly an extreme and dramatic, you know, illustration. However, you know, even in the everyday, you know, day-to-day kind of lives that we have, many of us have animals. Next slide. So I'd like to pose a question. You don't have to answer, but just think to yourselves, what percentage do you think of households in Canada report having at least one pet? And then the options that I put up there, let's see. I think you have to click, there we go. 18%, 38%, 58%, 78%. Next slide. So if you guessed 58%, and this was 2020, and I'm gonna guess very early, maybe even pre-pandemic, and we know adoptions have gone up. So chances are this is low, but we're talking well over half of households in Canada and in the States, you know, very parallel, well over half report having at least one pet. And of those, the majority report considering their animal to be family members. So this is something for many folks, that a resource that's already present in their lives. We're talking about over half of folks in Canada having at least one animal that they consider a pet, and many of them have a bond to. Next slide. So these are some pictures from public domain that are examples of how the animals that we share our lives with can show up in family roles. This is when I looked for holiday cards. You can see there's a group with paws and feet, and then, you know, snowy outdoors and an indoor pose. Next slide. I also searched family portraits. And here we go. We have, again, different kinds of family compositions. A couple of you know, single humans and animals, so kind of dyads that came up under family. But the animal definitely being a part of that. Next slide. And all the way up to what we could call quote unquote first families are leaders of countries, Prime Minister Trudeau, this was a few years back, got a dog named Kenzie. And this was puppy Kenzie meeting of one of the Trudeau family members. And this was, you know, posted on social media. So definitely we have this backdrop of animals having, you know, significant roles in many of our lives, irrespective of whether or how we think about them in terms of our own well-being. They're with us, they're part of our networks. Next slide. So we're going to look specifically at animals in our lives. What are the benefits that science has identified to varying degrees? And then, you know, what are some ways we can specifically build on those to help ourselves? And on the right, you see somebody being pretty physically active, like literally kind of a mid-run. On the left, feeding a bunny a carrot. Is that health producing? We'll talk about it. I mean, if the little boy's eating carrot, definitely, maybe not the same carrot as the bunny, but, you know, vegetables are good. So, but more than that, they're having some proximity. And if you look at that little boy's face, you know, he's looking like he's feeling pretty good. And he's looking right at that bunny. So we can make an assumption that there's something happening there. Next slide. So if we think about benefits, things that cause something to improve, to be better, there's two main ways animals can convey those to us. And the first, and by far the most common, going back to my coworker, and the low-hanging fruit are what we would call the natural benefits. So these are the things that happen just in day-to-day life with an animal. The animal is not trained to do anything special. If we look at the top picture, this is a woman, it looks like she's, you know, doing something in the kitchen, and she has a kitty on her lap. And kitty might be in the way. Woman's got a little smile. Conceivably, kitty is there. Kitty is allowed to be there. And maybe a positive, if you will, presence for the woman. Do you think the kitty was trained to sit up there? I don't know for sure, but I'm gonna guess probably not. My guess is that kitty thought that was a cool place to sit, not cool. I don't know what the feline, you know, something, someplace desirable, and kitty went up there and the kitty's person was okay with that. If we look on the bottom picture, however, we see something very different. We see a dog pressing a button. And the button is going to open a door that's not in the picture. That dog was trained to do that. That dog was likely trained to be on best behavior in public with bunches of distractions, all sorts of different settings, smells, noises, because if this is something that is needed, help opening a door, the dog needs to do it consistently, reliably, you know, whenever it's needed. So with what we call service animals, those are animals that are taught to do specific tasks to help somebody function better who has a health struggle, a disability. Those are benefits that happen through training or teaching. Not so low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of resources and time that goes into that. What I'm going to be talking about today are the natural benefits. Both folks in these pictures are using chairs, both conceivably having some, you know, positive benefit from the animals. With one, the animal has a fair amount of training. The other, I think, is a friendly domestic cat doing cat things. So next slide. So another caveat. So we have the natural everyday benefits that animals provide us through presence. How long do we need to know an animal, quote unquote? So I'm showing you a picture of two people with dogs, and one pair literally just met probably less than 60 seconds ago. The other pair has been together for about 12 years. If you look at the gentleman's faces, I'm kind of hard pressed to decide who's looking more, you know, who's got a bigger smile, who's looking more pleased in these pictures. So both folks are having a nice interaction. Just looking at the pictures, it might not be that easy to tell. It's the pair on the right that has been together for 12 years. The pair on the left just met. So some of the benefits we're gonna look at, this is why many of you, I'm sure, have heard of therapy dog, you know, hospital visitation programs, or, you know, animals going to crises or disasters or places where they provide comfort, and they've just met people, but there certainly are some benefits that can be conveyed pretty immediately, provided a person is not fearful of that species of animals, allergic, asthma, just not somebody who cares to interact with animals, any of those things, and these benefits aren't gonna be so, but they're not gonna be benefits. They may even be stressors. So that's important context. We're gonna be talking about, you know, the benefits, the natural benefits, mainly from the perspective of the animals that are in our lives that we live with. However, there's any number of ways that we can experience these benefits. You know, visiting animals at shelters, therapy animal visits, visiting a friend's animal, you know, having a grand dog or a, you know, something like that. There's you know, dog sitting for somebody, cat sitting, all sorts of ways. Next slide. So as we look at these benefits, and I'm gonna talk you through the benefits in terms of basically the dimensions of human functioning. We can think of ourselves, you know, human beings, you know, we're social mammals. We have biological aspects to ourselves. We have psychological, emotional, and of course we have social, our interactions with other humans, with other species. So, and if we think about all of those, kind of the confluence, the intersection you see in the middle is health. I mean, health is affected by our biology, it's affected by our behavior, it's affected by what happens in our social network. So fortunately for us and for, you know, those who do human-animal interaction research, the benefits line up very nicely in these categories. Next slide. So there's really four main types of these natural benefits falling nicely along those lines of human functioning. Now, how I'm showing you, I'm gonna talk through each separately, but keep in mind, just like we can't separate all those things out in our, you know, existence, it's really artificial to pull these apart like this. They're more like kind of all tangled together. But we have, of course, the physical kinds of benefits that animals provide us. We have the psychological benefits, the emotional and the social. So first, next slide, let's take a look at the physical. So my guess is if I asked folks what they thought physical benefits of animals would be, the one that most folks think of like pretty immediately is activity. You know, some of us have to spell out W-A-L-K or, you know, outside or, you know, our animals immediately clue into that. And I love walking with my dogs. I'm unlikely to go for a walk by myself, not because I don't want to, but I don't know, somehow in my head, I prioritize it differently. Having my dogs want that, like, bumps me over into doing it. And that's just me. So the activity is literally what you would think, animals helping us to be more active. physically moving, even fine motor skills, brushing, feeding, cleaning a litter box, all sorts of things that the animal requires, the animal can't do themselves. If we have an animal living with us, somebody needs to do that. And the second, this has gotten more attention in recent years, is what we would call contact related. And this really, so if we look at the pictures of the one in the top left corner in particular, the woman with the cat, but there's also the woman in the bottom corner kind of stroking her animal. These are what we would call, certainly there's movement. So that goes back to, it's all kind of tangled up, but contact. And what is being found through research is that when we have physical contact with our pets or other animals even that we have a liking for, so like a therapy dog we just met, or our neighbor's cat who we like to talk to. If we have an interaction with them that's positive, we tend to produce a chemical called oxytocin. And oxytocin is what is sometimes referred to as the love hormone. And it was discovered in breastfeeding studies, human breastfeeding studies, that where this oxytocin was emitted and was associated with slowed heart rate, slowed respiration or breathing rate, and slowed blood pressure, amongst other things, and sort of a general feel good, like warm fuzzy. And it has an evolutionary purpose. If we think about what we can do when we're infants, not much. We need an adult to bond to us and take care of us. We can sleep, we can cry, we can, pee and poop, we can eat. Hopefully we can do those things, but it's gonna be a long time before we're able to go out in the world and do for ourselves. So this oxytocin helps to create a bond. And from those studies, there was then this kangaroo care where physical contact, skin on skin, like lay the baby here, lay the baby on another caregiver. And that was thought to, release the oxytocin, backed up in studies, helped create bonds, helped the baby's well-being. Studies kept going and found, hey, guess what? Peer bonded humans, like we can hug a friend, a hug can do it. Even a gaze. So looking into the eyes of somebody, and certainly, but this is all sorts of love. So it's not limited to romantic partners by any means. Like I said, it started with babies and parents. And folks started looking at it with other species. So we found that we release it with dogs, with cats. Not only do we release it and have these changes in our cardiovascular, the animals do. So the animals will likewise have a sort of slowing of their neurological arousal. And again, the gaze there's been studies that have found even gazing at our dogs, eye contact can kick up our oxytocin and theirs. Folks are starting to look at pictures. You know how somebody has a cute picture on their cell phone, like, oh, I'm gonna show you my cute pup here. I haven't seen studies that specifically look at that yet, but I would not be surprised. Cause I'm kind of like, I feel like probably an oxytocin puddle when I look at baby pictures and like puppy and kitten pictures, I just do. Next slide. So here's oxytocin. Again, it's got a lot of functions. So it's thought to be maybe the linchpin in a lot of these benefits because it creates those warm, fuzzy feelings. It helps slow the things that tend to, when we're stressed, right? Because what happens when we go into fight or flight? Heart goes fast, breathing gets fast, blood pressure goes up. And the oxy directly brings those things down. Next slide. This is a statement from the American Heart Association. So this is a mainstream medical organization in the States that basically came out and said, we're not saying go and get a pet for better heart health. We are saying the research is, you know, pretty solid that there is a protective factor, and particularly with dogs. Next slide. And this was replicated in Sweden, where they have national healthcare. As my understanding is you all do, we don't in the States, but they were able to actually look at twin register data with I think like 35,000 folks and basically found the same thing, that this was protective. Next slide. And another large study that came out in 2020, specifically linking dogs and cats to less hypertension. Next slide. So we have this physiologic kind of group of benefits. Another body of research focuses on the psychological benefits. Sense of purpose. That's really how I started this talk. People talking about, basically I haven't acted on my suicidal thoughts because I can't leave my animal. I'm needed here. Like I can't, nobody else is going to care for my animal. Self-efficacy, you know, feeling like you're able to do something and do it well. Motivation, or in mental health, we sometimes call it like behavior activation, but it's basically if the bottom picture is a cat trying to get the person up because the cat wants to be fed. Top left, dog with the bowl. So they're actively engaging us in doing things. And then the role, if we think about how we identify ourselves in relation to our animals, I have the cat dad mug up there. But we have all sorts of ways we kind of think about, our animals and what we mean in relationship to that, and in meaningful ways. Next slide. And emotion, some kinds of research kind of lump psychological and emotional together. I pulled them apart just to kind of underscore, because I think this is another group that, you know, just if we think of activity, we think of the emotional. People talk about, you know, the feelings of well-being, comfort, affection, feeling less lonely. You know, is your animal the same as a person? They're not the same as a person. Do they have, you know, benefits that they can offer in terms of responsiveness and you know, affection? And, you know, sure. So that is pretty well documented. Next slide. Then we have the social benefits. And this is interesting. This is another, like the physical, which is broken into contact and activity. The social is broken into the obvious, direct. We have a woman celebrating her 90th birthday with her kitty. Up there, a woman sleeping with the kitty. The lower left, somebody hard at work with another kitty, and then we have pups. The two pictures on the right point to, in part, the second benefit. This is called in the literature, like research, you know, kinds of works, the indirect benefit of pets, which is they can serve as a bridge. They connect us to other people. And in a way that isn't always, connecting with other people isn't always as easy if you don't have the animal. There have been studies where they varied the clothes on the person, the dog, you know, they put studs on the dog, they put a big bow, they put nothing. And then they had the person wear the same things without the dog. And if I asked which situations the person got more smiles, more greetings. If you're guessing anything, anytime with a dog beat out anytime without a dog, you would be correct. Something about that, they're still figuring out, they being researchers, but at any rate, the indirect animals helping us to connect to other people. So we have a person stopping to pet somebody's dog, hopefully with permission, and interaction starts that way. And then we have you know, somebody taking a selfie with their dog that they then send to somebody else. So social benefits. There's also bigger picture kinds of research looking at like neighborhood connectivity, like how much do you talk to your neighbors, and do having animals help that? In this case, particularly dogs, but not always. Kitties sit in windows. And there have been documented instances where people have met through, you know, inquiring about a window kitty sort of thing. So next slide. Another way that the social benefits fit into human health and well-being is this idea of what is called the social determinants of health. This is basically the social factors that, my dog says hello, that was Mabel. the social factors that help to predict our health. You know, we have, of course, all these medical sort of, you know, things that affect our health, but there's also, you know, things related to, as far as, you know, animals, things like isolation and loneliness, researchers is pointing to as risk factors. We're more likely to have poor health outcomes if we're experiencing these things. With research, again, it's important to you know, underscore this is not a substitution for people. It's its own kind of companionship. And I have a study cited where older adult primary care patients had longer, let's just say who lived alone, reported less loneliness. There's also longevity studies that are being looked at. Next slide. And stress mediation effect is the phrase that is used to describe basically how oxytocin in part mediates all of it. Because if we're petting our animal and that oxytocin is going up, you know, we're having companionship, we're maybe feeling good, our physical indicators are going down. So we're just hitting the benefits, bing, bing, bing. Next slide. And I wanted to briefly share with you just an example from a healthcare system that is actually regional. So Ohio and Michigan primarily, but some other states as well. It's a nonprofit, you know, NGO called ProMedica, partnered with Toledo Humane Society. And then University of Toledo, that's where I'm at, we did the research on it, but essentially, you know, homeless animals, dogs, cats, next slide, were placed with people. Actually, let's jump one more slide. There we go. 12 people were referred by their healthcare providers. These folks had chronic mental health conditions and lived alone, had limited income, and were thought to, you know, to be at risk of social isolation by their healthcare providers. So we had a group of folks, we got some information, we did anxiety, depression, and loneliness scales, and then we got saliva and looked at oxytocin and cortisol. Cortisol is a stress hormone. They then adopted a dog or a cat. We followed up at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months. Home visits. Come in and ask them to give a sample of saliva. And thankfully, I have a colleague who is a kinesiologist and has a metabolic lab and did all of the analysis around the saliva. I've never handled so much saliva in my life, let me tell you. But so we got that first one, and then we asked the folks to interact, just like focus on their animal for 10 minutes, something positive. We didn't specifically pick an activity because it, if we think about, you know, how we interact with our animals, you know, one of you might have a dog that likes to play catch, another one, you know, likes the belly rub, you know, the kitty likes to play with the string, another kitty, you know, just wants to be pet or talked to. So we let the person pick, but 10 minutes, and then we did another vial of saliva. So we did that at all of those intervals. At 12 months, we did the anxiety, depression, and loneliness scales again. the saliva, you know, pre and post 10 minute one more time. And then we did open-ended interviews to talk with folks. Next slide. So what we found, statistically significant reductions in anxiety, depression, and loneliness. And again, these were folks that most of them were on disability for mental health reasons and had long-term mental health struggles. It did not reach statistical significance, so that's important. However, there was a consistent pattern after 10 minutes of oxytocin going up and cortisol going down. And we hadn't had any of this analysis done when we talked to the participants and basically asked them, what was it like living with the animal? What are your thoughts about the animal, you know, in terms of, you know, your health, your mental health, your well-being? And all of them very emphatically stated that they felt that their animals had helped their health and their mental health. So without, you know, seeing any of the other data, that was their perception. And some of the specific reasons for that that came out of the interviews, I looked for themes in each interview and what was happening across the interviews. Folks talked about, I take better care of myself. Like a lot of folks were taking medications when they fed their animal or when their dog needed a walk or to go out, you know, so that kind of prompted them. You know, talked about just having a sleep schedule, you know, not sleeping all day because a couple folks just flat out, you know, I feel bad like leaving my animal out there, you know, or so that motivation. And then of course, comfort, affection, distraction from the symptoms. So a person that's like, you know, feeling really anxious, really depressed, really sad, a number of folks said their animals kind of just knew and would approach them and sort of initiate an interaction that the folks then talked about, you know, finding distracting, and then the calming and soothing, which certainly fits that, you know, the oxytocin, the slowing of the cardiovascular triad. Next slide. So oxytocin, you can see the black is the, you know, beginning, the shaded is after 10 minutes. You can see the increases. Cortisol is the next one, and that's the opposite. It's a drop. Next slide. And then this is a quote from one of the participants and you know, picture used with permission. If it wasn't for him, there's no telling where I would be at right now. Mentally, physically, and emotionally, I'm better. So that was just a sense of pretty much what all the folks, not talking to each other, just, you know, this was their perceptions. Next slide. That brings us to questions. And thank you.
If there are questions, we can pop the questions into the chat box or unmute to ask the questions if okay. People are comfortable doing that. Sure. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm wondering what the pet lover we are, and we've had animals all our lives until recently, I guess. What is the impact in the converse of what you're saying in terms of the impact on the animal, on the, especially a dog or a cat that's around the house with you a lot when you're away or not ill? Do they notice that and that sort of thing? On the pet.
Great question, and one that is increasingly being looked at. There's a model called One Health, which is the idea that by elevating both the animal and the person well-being, both can be better. And certainly, you know, animals, that creature of habit, I don't know if that's a phrase in Canada, it's definitely one we use in the States, but animals are all about their routine. So they notice any deviation, and it certainly can, you know, be stressful, especially if it's a new change, if they're used to you being home every day at, you know, 4:30 and then it's, you know, 6:45, like that certainly is going to cause some stress for the animal. And, you know, in terms of interacting with an animal when we're stressed, like if I'm feeling stressed, I call my dog Henderson to me. You know, there's the possibility, I mean, they you know, might have a stomach ache, or maybe they have a sore muscle, you know, different things could be going on with them to where they may not be in a space where they want to go all, you know, snuggle, love. And not respecting that, you know, some people will hang on to their animals, not, you know, permit them to move away if you know, the animal's not into to being, you know, held for a prolonged period. Things like that can cause stress as well. So, you know, being mindful, it's a two-way street. It's a relationship. So being mindful of the animal's signals and communication. And then as you know, I think the initial part of your question, their routine. I'm a clinical social worker. So I'm not an animal behaviorist. So I'm answering, you know, I guess from my experiences, primarily with, you know, having animals and working with, you know, animal care professionals who are, you know, supporting clients, you know, that have therapeutic animals.
Thank you. I have another question, but I better leave time for someone else.
Appreciate the questions. Thank you.
No, you're welcome to ask the question for sure, because it might be something that somebody else is thinking of as well. So feel free, go ahead.
Well, the other thing I'm more concerned about, I guess, and concern is appropriate term for this one word. In the U.S., with your society of I shouldn't forget this one, but anyway, I run out of words easily because of age lately. The humane societies of Canada and the U.S. I've had some experience there, being on the board for a while, and our daughter was on there as well at another time. And we each observed something that we also have what we call a municipal animal control function, which is separate from the Humane Society, or SPCA, and so forth. But at one time I was in the middle of this sort of both organizations. One has been sort of not accused, but generally known, I guess, in some parts of our public group, that the one will put cats down, for instance, especially cats. We put them down very, very quickly, perhaps too soon, not waiting long enough to get them into a home. And the other extreme is they keep them in a cage for a year and a half or so. And what good is that to an animal? What does that do? I think it's awful personally, but these things happen. I'm not saying where, by the way, but that's mm-hmm. another issue. Yeah. So I'm wondering, have you been able to speak to any national organization associated with humane societies and those kinds of animal shelters across the US or Canada as a group, as some symposium they might have, to talk to them about that? Because it's a real sad thing when you're in the middle of it. It's ridiculous, but that's the way it is.
The kitties, you know, we have the same kinds of issues where we have many more cats don't get adopted, and higher cat euthanasia. Here's my cat, she says hello.
Yeah.
We have, you know, the point you make about, you know, the too quick euthanasia, of course, is, you know, tragic. And then the flip, the long stay kitty in the cage, you know, erodes their, you know, well-being. Over time. I mean, some animals can tolerate it. Some start to show compulsive, you know, behaviors, much like humans, you know, do, and they start to decompensate. I mean, a shelter is a pretty stressful environment for most animals. We have Maddie's Fund, which is a national organization that does a lot of training and funding of programs for long, not just long, all sorts of animal welfare initiatives. And there's also what's called human animal support services. It's a range of services to try to help keep pets in their homes and help keep, you know, both dogs and cats from even coming into a shelter. Now, these are, of course, animals who already have homes. That's a strategy. There's also programs. There's one that was just started recently here in Ohio for older long stay cats that would go with, it's, I think it's called Seniors for Seniors. So it puts older long stay cats with older adults who want to foster for long periods of time. The cats are, you know, not likely to be adopted, and it covers their food, their litter, their vet care. If for any reason, you know, the animal needed to go back, you know, if the person was unable to care for the animal. So I think there just needs to be a lot of out of the box thinking, because it's, you know, of course, the trap, neuter, release is another, you know, for cats that aren't in homes, they tend to reproduce pretty quickly. But I found Maddie funds.
It sounds like it's a very big issue for sure. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Could I make a comment?
Mm-hmm. Sure, go ahead.
I would like to respond to the previous question, the previous comment that the gentleman made regarding stress to animals if you're not there to pet them. My wife has dementia and I have a little dog, but we have a good support group. And if she were not there to take care of the little dog, our support group would take care of them. That's all I want to say.
That's excellent. That's exactly how we can, you know, keep their stress levels lower.
Can I ask a question? It's Bill Prawicki. Great presentation, by the way. But one thing I noticed living in the big city of Toronto, I had a lot of interaction with the homeless people. And have you ever done a study? Because I found most of them had a dog, and the dog was just unbelievably loyal and just attached to that person. Have you done any studies in respect to homeless and pets?
I have done one. It was a program evaluation. There's a organization, a national organization in the U.S. called My Dog Is My Home that works specifically with folks who are homeless and have animals. And what we did was do brief interviews of folks that had come to a service fair. So some veterinarians donated time, and some places donated food for animals and for people, and provided, you know, kind of a menu of services for folks who didn't have permanent housing and had animals. What we found was a lot of these folks did not even try to access, like try to get into, you know, formal homeless shelters, because they knew that they would be told to not, you know, get rid of their dog. Basically, and for them, they said that's not acceptable. So they were finding other ways, you know, to try to manage. There's a number of studies that mainly qualitative, so interviews, but that point to basically the same benefits we looked at, where people are taking care of themselves. Maybe they're, you know, feeling worn out, they're tired, but they go to places where there's pet food, and typically, you know, food banks that have pet food, not always, some just have pet food, but some have human food. And so they end up taking, you know, a bit better care of themselves because of their animal depending on them. So that some folks talked about feeling, you know, a sense of protection even, although many talked more about them protecting their animals. So kind of a mutual, I guess. And I think, yeah, those were the main, and I think there was also a tendency of, I'm thinking of one study where several folks said something to the effect of like, my dog eats before I do. Mm-hmm. So,
just if I could just say something,
please.
Thank you very much. Awesome. This is great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the field that I'm in is more coming from people bringing their animals to me so that we can help their animals, more like rehab and that kind of thing. And what I've noticed over the years is that there's the bond that's between, you know, the guardians or the humans, the parents of the dogs, is pretty darn incredible. And in a lot of cases, they tend to come to us as sort of a last resort. You know, what can we do? And you know, the medical system isn't quite working for whatever reasons. So watching the transformation of the dog and the people occurs at the exact same time. So when the dog starts to feel better, the people feel better. And then it just compounds itself all the way up. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to see that it goes very much both ways. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to add that since you're wonderfully describing so many things. It's very wonderful. Thank you for your talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your comment. That is very much, I think, the observation and experience that there's a mutuality.
Definitely lots to talk about with this for sure. Now I'm mindful of the time and it is 6:26. Jen Gilmore, I'm going to take my lead from you. Do we have a few more minutes or is this sort of the end of the time?
Time for one or two. I see there is one question posed in the chat that was posed earlier. Maybe
co-sleeping.
Yes. Can you speak to that, Dr. Hoy Gerlach?
So certainly there are folks who will say they sleep better with their animals, you know, co-sleeping. I know there's some research that points to the opposite. I guess I would say it's inconclusive and it would depend. For some folks, it can be disruptive if, you know, their animal's restless or they're restless and they wake their animal. For other people, they lay down, their animal lays down, they curl up, you know, and everybody's out. So I have not seen a conclusive, like, it's great or, you know, don't do it. It's yeah, I mean, it can be disruptive depending on the combination, the person's sleep habits and hygiene, and then, you know, what the animal is like at the time the person sleeps. Sorry to not have a more definitive. I can follow up if that's helpful. I'm actually kind of curious. I'd be happy to do a look through the research and send to Jen if you want to forward that, see if we could find anything more conclusive.
Well, I think that's all we have time for tonight. So before we end, I did just want to give a few thank yous. So first off, thank you to Dr. Hoy Gerlach for joining us tonight and sharing your knowledge and your experience. It's really clear that you're passionate about this. It's really interesting to hear about it as really an emerging science and an emerging science base, I guess, and just hear the different ways our animals can impact us. Thank you. I also do want to thank Denise again for both connecting us first off with Dr. Hoy Gerlach and also for facilitating tonight's discussion. And finally, a thank you to the community for joining us. Our community and guests like yourselves are really the reason that PACE has grown to what it is. And we always enjoy seeing everyone, even virtually, and having these conversations. So if anyone has any future topics or speakers they'd like to suggest, please get in touch with us. And keep an eye on pacetalks.com for future sessions.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good presentation.
Great.
So much.
Great. Thank you.
Bye. Bye, and thank you.
Thank you.